Today's call will focus on the area of the market that has dominated most people's conversations in the industry and certainly dominated the headlines as well for the past several months, and that is the fixed income market. Today, we'll discuss and explore our outlook on fixed income, address concerns around the potential for interest rates to continue to rise, and discuss opportunities that do exist within fixed income despite our prospects and others for a rising interest rate scenario. Joining me today is Bill Coley. Bill joined Putnam in 1994 and manages funds such as Putnam's Diversified Income Trust, Global Income Trust, and the Income Fund. His expertise lies in global rates and currencies, and he also oversees our portfolio construction efforts. In today's conversation, we're going to focus on four risks that we see in the fixed income marketplace, those being what we describe as term structure risk or interest rate risk, credit risk in various forms, prepayment risk, and then finally liquidity risk. At the end of our conversation, we're going to open it up to the call to address your questions. And just as a reminder, and I'll give you this again at the end, when you want to ask a question, just press star 1 to get into the queue. So with that, I'll kick it off with Bill with a couple of questions, and then we'll open it up to the audience, and hopefully we'll get more. So Bill, to kick things off, the big issue in the marketplace today is the Fed and how their discussions will continue going forward about taking their foot off the gas pedal, so to speak, and ending their bond purchase program, which started back in 2009 as a reaction to what was going on in the markets back then. So the issue that the marketplace continues to be struggling with and the Fed is struggling with is how they're going to manage this process going forward. So what's our view here at Putnam, and how do we think this is going to play out?
Great. Thanks, Mike. Hello, everybody, and thanks for joining the call. So let me give you just a couple parameters around our interest rate view with a caveat that, you know, clearly we've moved a long way in a hurry. June was a particularly violent move overall. But we're probably in a period here of kind of stabilization in the near term. But if we look out over the next year to 2 years, our expectation is that we're still moving higher in rates. That as we normalize the liquidity conditions, the market sentiment, the risk appetite of investors, you know, we will look at a higher rate structure overall. So in the near term, you know, we may have seen the cap at 2.75, let's say, on the U.S. 10-year, provided we kind of, you know, we don't get any data surprises overall. Clearly, on Friday, I think we were set up for higher rates again. If we'd gotten an above expectations number on the employment data, I think we would have pushed up and challenged the rate range that we set earlier. But we do expect that rate range to change down the road, to move higher, I guess, down the road. And I wouldn't be surprised to see us at 3 or 3.5% by the middle of next year overall. So, let me just talk a little bit about the whole tapering and transition aspect of this generally. So our in-house view is that the tapering will start in September, provided we don't get any surprisingly weak data in August coming out, and we don't anticipate that. The U.S. economy still has issues about, you know, kind of the post-2008 landscape, but definitely it's one of the better one of the economies that are in better shape at this stage of the cycle, primarily because we were so aggressive in dealing with some of the structural issues that were out there, the liquidity provisions, the bond buying programs. Everything that was instituted has allowed us, you know, we were kind of first in the pool, and we're going to be the first ones through the, you know, to come out and back into this normalization process. The quantitative easing tapering discussion is really built on trying to transition to a more normal environment. You know, we've been in a state for the last several years where the Fed has been providing the stability and liquidity for the markets, and clearly the desire there is to step away from that. It's very, very difficult. In fact, I don't think it's possible to move from, you know, kind of the one state with the Fed involved and fully engaged in quantitative easing and the state where they're not involved in the market intervention. And so this tapering process is part of the conversation around transitioning from these two different environments. And so I think that, you know, you could view the June and the post-June data, you know, reaction and performance of the markets as a failure on Bernanke's part or on the market's part to kind of make that adjustment. But I actually think that, you know, all things being equal, the transition so far is probably doing what they want to do. They want to introduce the risk of, you know, the Fed moving away from the markets. They want to do it without destabilizing asset markets, and they've, you know, the stock market's been remarkably stable. Even the spread markets after the hiccup in high yield and some of the other sectors of the markets in June have stabilized and have improved again. So I think if I'm at the Fed, I'm feeling pretty good about the way things have gone so far. You've got it on the near-term horizon, this event to start, and you have, you know, you've done it without really significantly damaging either the asset markets or the kind of the risk aptitude or risk risk preferences of the investing public either.
Thanks. So this backup that we've seen now, roughly 100 some odd basis points from early May to where we are today, from the 160 level, I guess, to roughly 260, 265. And then, as you mentioned, the prospect for higher rates has certainly made advisors much more aware and much more concerned about interest rate risk and duration, as we know. Many of our funds, like Diversified Income Trust or the suite of absolute return funds that we manage in fixed income, the Absolute Return 100 and 300, have what we kind of term as neutral duration type stance in the marketplace. Or I think the term you used earlier today was managing strategies where we're de-emphasizing interest rate risk. Can you explain this a little bit in terms of where we do see the better opportunities?
Sure. I think this is a perfect environment for these for diversified income trusts and absolute return. And you know, you mentioned in the introduction, Mike, four types of risks out there: term structure risk or interest rate exposure, credit risk or the risk that, you know, your counterparty doesn't pay you back when the bond comes due, prepayment risk where the borrower has the option to pay you at their preference. Very dominant risk in the mortgage market, but also in high yield and other callable corporate securities that are out there. And then liquidity risk, which essentially is just, you know, it's pricing risk in bonds. So, you know, those first three risks, if I'm doing my job properly through our process here, you know, we can hedge out those first three risks through tools, diversification, using derivatives, through certain types of security selection. We can eliminate term risk and credit risk and prepayment risk. You still end up with a residual spread or yield on a security when you've hedged those out, and that's the pricing risk. I know if I hold that bond with those hedges in place to maturity, I'm going to get that return, but if I have to sell it for some reason or I choose to sell it, I may not get the price I want. So that's that fourth risk, the pricing or liquidity risk. If you've seen us or talked to us before, you know, we have a chart that we use that shows that, you know, the aggregate index, and by definition, anybody who's managing against the aggregate index looks like it's diversified. You know, if you look at the aggregate index, it's got, you know, roughly a third in treasury bonds, roughly a third in corporate bonds, roughly a third in mortgages. So you look at that and you say a third, a third, a third. Well, I've got, you know, I'm getting different types of risks in my portfolio. But the truth is, when you break those things down and you look at them, they are dominated by interest rate risk. It's an overwhelming percentage of the risk in that index is interest rate risk. And if you're managing against that index and managing closely to that index, or you're styling yourself off that index, that is the dominant risk that you're going to get. We find interest rate risk still very unattractive. It could be that, you know, we slow down and the markets rally and we, you know, we're not growing at the pace that we think and rates rally from here. I'm not saying that's not a possible outcome, but of all the things that are going on out there right now, I find interest rate exposure the least attractive of those four risks. So we have other tools in these portfolios, and the nice thing about these portfolios is we can use those tools and we're not accountable to interest rate risk. So effectively, in the absolute return funds and the diversified income trust, we don't have any interest rate exposure right now in the portfolios. You know, the rates up or rates down is not really impacting the performance of the funds at all. And in fact, we have several strategies that look much better in a higher rate environment generally. And so I think that's an important thing to remember. So the other areas that we find attractive, most of them are still, you know, deeply rooted in the events of 2008. 2008 was a huge dislocation in the fixed income markets. We're still recovering in liquidity risk in many sectors of the market. So if you look at, you know, particularly as you can imagine in mortgages, where you had this huge dislocation, large market out there, a core set of buyers, banks and insurance companies and other types of managers and some even some dealers, if you go back to Lehman and Bear Stearns, that no longer exist or no longer have a preference or can no longer hold those types of securities, and those securities have to get transferred to somebody else. Well, you know, we are a willing participant in that. We love those securities because, again, you're getting very attractive liquidity premiums in those securities still today. So non-agency mortgages like Alt-A or some of the prime loans that are out there, commercial mortgage-backed securities, the mortgage-backed derivatives market, the agency IO paper, and even the high-yield market, to some extent, I could make a case, is driven a lot by liquidity risk right now rather than by fundamental risk and default, you know, potential for defaults in those markets overall. So these products, you know, are really capitalizing on those sectors of the market which we think still offer value, and we're, you know, really de-emphasizing or staying away from the interest rate risk there overall.
So you bring up a couple spread products there in credit space and mortgage space I want to talk to you about in a second. But before we leave the concept of duration, I think the question that we often get from advisors, because this tends to be second nature, but I think for many people it's not, could you just give a simple example of how we buy a bond and hedge out that interest rate risk to take us to a zero duration type strategy?
Sure. I'll give you a couple of examples of, you know, I think of ways that we remove interest rate risk from the exposure. So through hedging, simply through the use of a futures contract or a swaps contract, we can essentially look at the cash flows on a bond and sell essentially an offsetting exposure to interest rates either in the futures market or in the swaps market that essentially will reverse mirror any move in rates impact on the bond. So if I buy, you know, in a very simple case, which would be probably not worth it in most instances, but if I bought a 10-year U.S. Treasury bond, I could sell 10-year U.S. Treasury futures against it and essentially would immunize the rate move up or down in that security, because any rise in rates that would hurt my Treasury, I would make up for in a price gain on my futures contract. Now, that's a very, very simple example that I'm giving you there. But I'll give you a couple that are, you know, one that's more evident in the portfolio. So let's look at the high-yield market today. And I know that there's a lot of interest right now, and I think this is a good example of about how we manage in this portfolio in the way that we run this portfolio and how we're a little bit unique. But we get a lot of questions right now on bank loans. And I think people are buying bank loans because they see a move higher in interest rates. And they say, well, bank loan's a floating rate note. And so I know that if rates move higher, then I'm going to be covered or protected then in that sort of an environment. The thing about a bank loan is it has prepayment risk associated with it. It essentially is refinanceable at the bank's whim when credit spreads move in their favor. So if we're looking at a world where economic growth looks more attractive down the road and access to capital for corporations looks better, and corporations can generally borrow at cheaper levels to the Treasury market or to the swaps market than they have been over the last 4 or 5 years, which I think is a very, very real outcome out there. Because, again, as I said earlier, you know, banks haven't been lending. The capital markets have been seized up. It's corporate borrowing spreads have been relatively expensive because of the events of 2008, 2009. So I think in your scenario of sort of rate normalization, economic normalization, you have to assume that that corporate borrowing costs come down. If I get a bank loan in that space, then I'm going to get called away. You know, the bank is going to essentially, the corporation is going to decide that essentially they can borrow at cheaper levels relative to LIBOR at some point down the road, and they'll refinance that loan, and I will not capture that value of that move. So that bond is callable away. We, on the other hand, you know, I love high yield here, and we're buying high yield bonds and hedging out the interest rate risk. So if you look at a typical high yield bond that's got a duration or interest rate risk of around 4 years, I can get out and I can buy a pool of high yield bonds, and I can sell treasuries, or what we use as swaps, essentially use swaps in the whole portfolio to hedge out the interest rate exposure of those bonds. But what I've done is I've locked in that borrowing spread in my favor over 4 years. So if those borrowing costs drop and it becomes more, you know, it becomes easier for corporations to borrow, I capture that in my four-year strategy by locking that in. So we would much rather own that high-yield bond duration hedged in the portfolio rather than own a bank loan right now in the strategy. And I think that's, you know, that served us well in the last as corporate bonds, corporate borrowing costs have come down overall. I'm going on here, but I want to just make one other example about, you know, how you might buy a security or how you might protect against a rise in rates in the portfolio. I mentioned agency CMOs or IOs earlier. An IO is an interest-only security that is an agency piece of paper that is essentially tied into how you can, you know, how quickly a homeowner can refinance their agency mortgage. So if you think about what drives refinancing rates, historically the primary driver there has been interest rates, right? So as rates fall, it becomes easier for, you know, it becomes desirable or beneficial for a homeowner to refinance their loan. And so that interest-only security is likely to be called away from you under that space. Conversely, if rates rise, it becomes less attractive for a homeowner to refinance. And so the likelihood is that the loan stays outstanding longer, in which case your IO increases in value because it's because you're going to hold it, but you're going to get the cash flows for longer associated with it. So duration or sensitivity, duration is a measure of sensitivity to interest rates. In most cases, as rates fall in value, your bond goes up in value. As rates go down, your bond goes up in value. As rates rise, your bond goes down in value. But for these IO securities, because of this refinancing risk, which is the dominant risk in these securities, as rates rise, they actually go up in value, and as rates fall, they go down in value. So they have a negative duration associated with them. So if we hold those in the fund, they actually have the impact of essentially lowering the duration, the overall duration of the fund, you know, significantly. And today we hold roughly, you know, 20% or so in those types of securities in the portfolio.
Perfect. Thank you. Great examples, and you covered a couple of the asset classes actually I wanted to get to. So why don't I throw one more at you and have you opine on this, and then we'll open it up to questions from the folks on the phone. You mentioned briefly the non-agency RMBS market as one of the types of credit exposure that we have in the fund, but in this case, mortgage credit. Clearly starting to see signs of kind of a nice rebound in the housing market. Case-Shiller Index came out last week up about 12%, prices on an annual basis. So, you know, starting to see signs of the housing market rebound. How does that impact our view on residential MBS market?
Yeah, and I think it's important there, Mike, too. And I, you know, just to say, you know, we're talking about two different mortgage strategies here, right? So we just talked about IOs, that's agency paper, all about prepayment risk. And as you highlighted, this sector of the market in the non-agency side is all about credit. And this is, are you going to get paid back or not, or how much are you going to get paid back? So it's very important here is not the refinancing risk, but is the value of the collateral or the homes that are sitting behind these loans, these pieces of paper, these bonds that are out there. So you want to know in this security, you want housing prices higher because it's going to increase the value of the securities that you're holding overall. The housing market, I think, is one of the most, you know, the clearest reason that the U.S. economy looks as strong as it does. You know, we clearly have gone through a major restructuring there. Again, we're on the back end of the stress in that area of the market, and you know we're seeing significant housing strength as you highlighted in the Case-Shiller data. I believe that one of the decision points that will be being made here, along with this tapering discussion and the transition of the Fed sort of making the decision to move away from the quantitative easing program, is the stability and the continued stability and strength in the housing market. They clearly, nobody wants to see the housing market derail. It's an important part of the U.S. economy. It seems to have its, you know, its feet under it again. Access to financing, certain sectors of the regional sectors are clearly stronger than others that are out there. So, and we've also, I should say, had a meaningful move in borrowing costs in that area, so that, you know, that long-term 30-year loans in that space that got maybe, you know, close to sub 3% are up over 4% now on the back of the move higher in Treasury rates that's taken place over the last few months here overall. We don't see any signs yet that that's had significant impact on housing, on the housing flow or the housing theme that's out there. And I believe that that's a data point that the Fed will be watching, along with the employment data, et cetera, that's out there. And housing's obviously tied into employment as well. It's a major part of the economy. So if we got into a situation where it looked like, you know, there was some sensitivity in the housing market to the rate volatility or rate moves, or that there was, that it looked like there was going to be some significant impact, I think they would back off that tapering path or trajectory until they got some stabilization there overall. So one of our primary assumptions here is that conversation about that transition is very much dependent on the U.S. economy and, you know, as a primary source of that economy strength, the housing market generally. So we think the housing market's going to hold up fine.
Perfect. That's good. So you've covered our kind of our overall macro view, our view on rates and duration positioning in the fund, and then a couple different strategies. Why don't we open it up at this point to those on the phone and see if we have any questions. Nika, could you poll for questions? And again, if you want to ask a question, press *1 to get into the queue.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Once again, to ask a question, press *1 and record your name when prompted. One moment, please, for the first question. Our first question is from Robert Gray. Your line's open.
Thank you. With an outlook for the next 12 months, what would you say your duration range will be within diversified income trust?
Good. That's a great question. Let me start off with a caveat before I get into it, and that is to say that, you know, duration in its purest sense is not necessarily the best indication of rate sensitivity in the portfolio. So just be clear that, you know, sometimes I know we've posted numbers you've probably seen that have been, you know, negative 1.5 to negative 2 years. We've been, I think if you look at the June data, as we traded to the top end of the range, we actually got a little bit long. We were up to about a year or a year and a half of duration exposure in the portfolio overall. I always, you know, put this out as just to say, listen, I anticipate very little sensitivity to interest rate moves generally. I wouldn't be looking at this as a big bet on higher rates in the portfolio, but just that, you know, we can do well in a higher rate environment generally. So with that caveat in place, I would say it's very unlikely we get longer than, you know, a year in the portfolio in over your 12-month horizon. You know, where might we get to that level? Well, if we got out, you know, if we had another big run-up in rates, and let's say we got to 3.5% before the end of the year here or something like that, we might take a tactical position that would take us, you know, something up on that end of the range. But in general, I would say, if I can say 85 or 90% of the time, I would anticipate the duration posture being between a very small positive, so I'm talking about, you know, maybe 0.25 years, something like that, to a range that might get down as low as a year to a year and a half negative. Now that includes estimations on the sensitivity of the IOs that we talked about here. It also, you know, if I'm short in, let's say, in Japanese government bonds, they have a different volatility or a different rate sensitivity than U.S. Treasuries do. So there's lots of stuff like that that's in there working. And I don't like to get too caught up in a specific number. But I would be very comfortable saying that if you have a view about higher rates, that should not be, you know, that's not going to damage this portfolio. I think we'll do very well in a higher rate environment. And we can, you know, survive a move lower in rates without having any significant issues as well. We're not going to rally like you'd find in, say, our income fund or something like that. You know, we're not going to show any significant sensitivity to interest rates. So if you have a strong view about lower rates from here, you know, you can find probably find better portfolios out there to express that view than this particular one.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. Our next question is from Joe Darpel. Your line's open.
Hello. Yes, I have a couple of questions. The number one question I have is that the Putnam income in rising interest rates, how does that, you know, do, and how does it do in a declining interest rate environment? Secondly, there was an interesting article in this week's Barron's publication by the Jay Levy and Associates. They were looking for 10-year Treasury yields to get below 1%. And it was also talking about that Richard Koo, the economist, talking about the a balance sheet recession. What's your thoughts on these?
Okay, that's a pretty wide topic. So let me handle the income fund first. And I think, you know, just, you know, use that as an example to talk about diversified income trusts as well, just to kind of contrast the two. So basically, you know, the funds run similar types of strategies in terms of where the markets that they find attractive. Diversified income trust is a riskier fund, you know, but uses below investment grade much more liberally, and it also uses global markets, whereas the income fund does not. But essentially, you know, you're using the same generation of ideas here at Putnam in those two products. But they're very, very different products in terms of the way they'll behave in sensitivity to interest rates. Diversified Income Trust has no accountability and no benchmark accountability to any kind of interest rate exposure. So it starts as kind of zero as its assumption around what kind of duration posture that it wants and moves around that overall. So in a big rate move higher, we should be fine. In a big rate move lower, that's not going to have a big impact on the portfolio either. The income fund, however, is very accountable to the aggregate index. The assumption there is that you're going into that portfolio because you want some sensitivity to interest rates. And so it has a longer duration of, you know, it ranges to, you know, 4 to 5 years in duration generally. But it uses all the same tools that Diversified Income Trust is. So if you look at it and compare it to the aggregate index, it actually does much better in a rising rate environment than the index does. It doesn't mean it's going to be up in absolute terms, but we think it will outperform significantly the index in a sell-off in rates. And you saw that in June. If you looked at the portfolio, you had a big move in rates, and the income fund outperformed the aggregate index significantly in that space. If you think rates are moving sharply lower, the income fund would be a much better fund to hold than Diversified Income Trust, because that sensitivity to interest rates means that you're going to capture a lot of that rate move lower as well. And so I think you have to be aware of that. And I think, again, what we're trying to do is distinguish the construction around these two products and have one that is accountable to that interest rate exposure, and that's the income fund, and the Diversified Income Trust, which really stays away from, you know, having any kind of set exposure to that overall. Let me go to your second question then about, you know, the possibility of 1% rates. And I didn't see the article, I'm sorry, but if you're talking about on the 10-year Treasury note, which I assume would be kind of the rough level there, you're going to have to assume some kind of you know, economic meltdown, I think, to get to those types of levels, right? So you're going to need a depression type of a scenario, that would justify a big economic slowdown and a flight to quality. My own feeling is that's a very, very unlikely outcome. You know, you could tell a story where we get some kind of an inflation-driven disruption or something like that that would end up in a collapse that would effectively take us to those levels. But I think we've had the risk event. You know, 2008 I've been managing money since the late 1980s, and 2008 was, you know, was orders of magnitude beyond any kind of risk event that I've seen out there. And I think that was the market clearing event overall. And we're in a healing period that, you know, we're still working our way through it, but we're going through that overall. And then you mentioned a sort of a balance sheet recession, I think, or something like that, which, you know, if you look at the corporate level, that'd be very hard to say, because corporate cash balance sheets are as strong as they've ever been, you know, in terms of the level of cash, the quality that's out there. That looks, you know, there's been a real, you know, a real, that's been a very, you know, a very positive trend there. If you're talking about the federal level, you know, that's a very active debate that's going on out there. But one thing I will say is that the balance sheet improvement that's taking place right now on the federal level is outstanding. I don't know if you've looked at the numbers, and I don't have the data right here in front of me, but we have a couple of charts internally and can probably look and see if that's you know, something to send out, that we could send out and make it available out there. But the corporate tax receipts are above, you know, above and beyond anybody's wildest expectations at this level, and personal tax receipts as well. So there's an underlying strength to the economy that maybe not showing up completely in the GDP numbers or the employment data just yet. The money that the agency paper that the, you know, Fannie and Freddie paying back into the federal coffers is well above the projected trajectory there overall. So if you looked at those numbers, you know, that looked so dire 2 or 3 years ago, They've really reversed trend. And I think one of the things, you know, a talking point you're going to see over the next 6 months or so is going to be just how strong the level of improvement is on the federal level overall. Now, there's still state problems, right? I mean, I know there was a big article today on the Chicago unions and, you know, the shortfalls in the some of the pension funds in Illinois, et cetera. I think you're still going to see balance sheet issues that are out there. But if I were, again, as a, you know, if I'm gaming this, I think that the sensitivity to that has already happened, and that, you know, that if anything, people might be positively surprised that things look relatively better on a forward-looking basis than they do right now.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Our next question is from Chris Gerber. Your line's open, sir.
Hello, Bill.
Hi.
I've heard all the hoopla about rising interest rates hurting bond prices, and I know how that works. However, something I never hear anyone talk about is how you folks can buy bonds, and yet maybe short-term interest rates rise and your bond prices are hurt, but by golly, you can just hold those bonds until maturity if you want to, or until they're called, or anything else, and come out with a decent return. And this flies in the face of general expectations of horrible price or horrible performance on bond funds for a prolonged period as interest rates rise. Well, it doesn't necessarily have to happen, and could you address that concept?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you're right in concept. The question is if you hold to maturity, right? So in funds and in any bond, really, it's priced daily. It's based on, and we, I, one of the, well, let me start over again. Sorry, I'm going to, let me form this a little bit better. Your concept is correct. If you've correctly analyzed the prepayment risk and the credit risk, you know you're going to get paid back at the end of the day, so you're not, you know, your counterparty is still going to be there. Then you really have only have liquidity risk or pricing risk associated with it. So the question is, you know, do you buy a 10-year bond today at 260, or do you wait for 2 years and buy a 2-year bond right now for a much lower yield, but hold it for 2 years and hope that you can buy your 10-year bond for maybe 3% or 4% a year or two down the road from now? That's that term structure risk that that we highlighted earlier. So you're absolutely correct that, you know, you could be in a situation where you hold a series of bonds, some maturing next year, some maturing 3 years from now, some maturing 5 years from now, or longer, and then reinvest those proceeds along the way. And if you don't look at the day-to-day pricing of those bonds, then you'll probably be very happy with the return that you get, even in a rising rate environment down the road, because you're going to get essentially higher income associated with the higher yields down the path. The problem is that, you know, that everything's mark to market, and essentially if I buy a 10-year bond today, it has a sensitivity to interest rate rises, right? That sensitivity is that opportunity cost you have where you could have waited and bought it a year from now. Let's just look at June. So in June, what was the rise in interest rates, Mike? Did you say it earlier, or was it? It was close to 100 basis points.
It was 100 basis points from the May lows, yeah.
So from May to the end of June, we went up 1% in 10-year yields. In the beginning of June, in that May period, that 10-year Treasury note had roughly a 9-year duration, a little bit more than that. Duration is a measure of the sensitivity to interest rates. So that tells you that if you move 1% higher in rates, you're going to lose 9% of the value of that bond. That's essentially reflecting the opportunity cost you had, where if you had waited, you could have reinvested at much higher yields 6 weeks or, you know, later or something like that. So while I agree with your concept, my fund and most people's time horizons, I guess, are priced, you know, are shorter than that, and you're looking at prices and looking at sensitivities and looking at opportunities for other investments, different than that. And so that duration measure essentially is telling you that you're not going to be penalized by investing today in this portfolio at zero duration, because even if you get a big move higher in rates, you're not going to get that impact, that opportunity cost or that pricing cost in the fund the way it's positioned right now. That makes sense. So we go to the next question.
Yes, sir. Next question is from Scott Johnson. Your line's open.
Oh, thank you, Bill, for having us today. I really had two questions. One is, what consideration will the Fed take in regard to rising interest rates on the federal budget deficit? And then secondly, something that's unrelated, what do you see going on in the muni market as a result of what's happening in Detroit?
Okay, I'm going to put a caveat out there, which is I'm not a muni expert. Usually the muni question is my first one I get, and I have to say that right off the bat. Mike can talk about that
a little bit.
But we can come back to that in a second. I thought you were going to ask about the interest rate sensitivity in munis, which I can talk about. My impression has been that the Federal Reserve and the Treasury have shown little sensitivity to the effect of rising interest rates on the deficit numbers. You know, I think it's at best a second or tertiary concern for them, and maybe even lower down the risk than that. I still think that, you know, in the list of the potential outcomes of that could be problems, they don't see that as a significant one. I think they're still worried about a slip back into a disinflationary spiral or a deflationary spiral. I think they're worried about the confidence in the market and the access to liquidity. Now, I think we're miles from where we were 3 years ago, and that's the reason you're having this tapering discussion and everything else. I think that they're feeling much better about it, and maybe it's not so skewed, the risk reward on that as it was at some stage. But I think that if you told them that they were going to have a problem because rates were higher, because inflation was higher down the road, and that was going to have an impact on the budget deficit, I think they might actually like that outcome to some extent, because it meant that they'd solved these other problems and we'd kind of moved into a new set of issues. It's much easier, I think, generally for the Federal Reserve to deal with inflationary risks than disinflationary risks, because they can clearly move rates to kind of control those expectations over time. You know, interestingly, I saw that we were getting ready to issue a floating rate note on the Treasury market for the first time, which should give you a sense that they are pretty confident that they can control any of those interest rate those interest rate concerns down the road. If they're willing to put floaters out there, and have that as part of their platform, I think that it states that they're pretty confident they know what they're doing on that space. Did you want to talk about munis?
Well, with the caveat that I'm not a muni expert either, but I did sit through a meeting where Thalia Meehan, who runs our muni group, spoke about 2 hours ago that Bill was not in. So I'll try to share some of Thalia's thoughts with you, because she was asked a question about Detroit as well. Couple things I think that she mentioned that are noteworthy. One is that the city of Detroit has been trading like a distressed credit now for the better part of 10 to 15 years. So I don't think the way things played out necessarily caught people by surprise, other than the speed at which it did once the executive manager reached a point where he could not get bondholders to negotiate with him. And he's coming more from a corporate bankruptcy background than necessarily municipality bankruptcy background, so it's just his approach. And some people are happy with his approach and others are not so happy. The big question obviously is there another shoe to drop, like always with the muni market? Once we've had one high profile type default, is there another one? In Chicago was mentioned, Bill mentioned there's an article in the paper today, and her view is Chicago is definitely not is not the next Detroit. She said, again, hopefully there are no folks from Gary, Indiana on the phone, but she said, Gary, Indiana could be the next Detroit, but clearly that's a different situation altogether, much similar to Detroit, where you had one very dominant industry that's dried up and it's impacted that local economy, and it's clearly not as big a city as Detroit, so the impact would not be as big. We continue to believe broadly that, whereas there will be a handful of high profile defaults in the muni market, on a scale size it's still relatively small. Defaults in the muni market are much smaller than we've ever seen in the corporate credit market, and we think a lot of that has been, quite frankly, priced in. If anything, to Bill's point, the bigger issue I think right now that the muni market is dealing with is duration, where it's a longer market in general from a duration standpoint, so interest rate moves higher can certainly impact people's bond prices.
Thank you, guys.
Sure. Thanks. Nika, were there a couple more questions on the phone, potentially? Two more?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We have two more. And the next one is from Brian McCarron. Your line's open.
I saw, everything kind of went down after May 22nd, including your funds. And I wanted to see whether, in some of these I've been prepared. I had high-yield bond funds that had low durations and these kind of things. And yet they obviously still went down. I saw we had, record bond outflows. Do you think that was more a product of liquidations and that caused maybe some of the spreads to increase? Or why do you think that was? I kind of been positioning for this for a while, and yet it didn't seem to really matter when the moment came. Thanks.
Well, let me just say one. First of all, I think you have to be careful about taking anything over too short a time period. So I would say that I think the diversified fund and our absolute return funds, if you can look at them over kind of a 3 to 4 week period, did quite well. Even that was a pretty sharp move in rates generally. And I think we were the only fund, or one of the only, maybe one or two funds that were up in total return space over that window of that move that you saw.
Gotcha.
But I think that, I do think that you bring up a good point. And so I've got, as you've probably figured out by now, I ramble on these questions. I have two possible explanations for what you're talking about, and I think one of them is the one that you highlighted, which is, you had big liquidations, you had liquidity shocks in several sectors of the market. And so for the first time in some time, you had rates move higher, but also spreads widen at the same time. So high yield underperformed treasuries. Certain areas of the mortgage market underperformed treasuries. Interestingly, the IOs that we mentioned earlier, they'd gotten really hurt in the beginning of the quarter. They actually had a very strong June, because as rates were moving like that, you were removing refinancing risk from the markets, and they actually rallied quite sharply in that environment. So that that liquidation risk is high, and so one of the things that I think is an advantage for us is that we're still relatively small. We can be pretty nimble, but you obviously have some large structural positions out there in dedicated high yield funds, in funds that are running a lot of that are essentially running against the benchmark, the index, that are, you know, very sensitive to these interest rate moves, where they were in net liquidation phase. So that's one potential, you know, probably the most probable reason that we had that reaction in June. The other reason is a little bit more subtle, but I think is a thing to keep in mind as we look forward here, and it has to do with this transition of to tapering and everything, and that is that under the perfect scenario right now is, listen, the U.S. economy continues to normalize and improve. Again, not booming, not a typical cyclical recovery, but it, you know, continues to move forward. That normalization should mean that the real returns that are being offered in the equity market, in the high yield market, in the corporate markets, et cetera, continue to look attractive. So you could see a world there where rates move up, but stocks continue to do well, high yield does well, these other sectors, the non-interest rate sensitive markets and the fixed income market do well. But the counterpart to that is, well, maybe rates move up too quickly and it destabilizes this recovery scenario and the tapering scenario. And under that scenario, a rate move higher starts to, you know, gets people nervous and questions, you know, they question the viability of the recovery, of the asset market's ability to perform going forward. So stocks get hurt, and high yield gets hurt, and some of these other sectors get hurt as well. So I think that, you know, we had a very sharp move over a 5 or 6 week period. We were probably touching on the level where, okay, well, now maybe that second scenario looks to be more probable than that first scenario, in which case, then that's kind of where you hit the wall there a little bit, and you saw those, different reactions. And I think that's what caused, you know, the Fed to come out and say, listen, we're not moving that quickly. You know, they came out and very quickly tried to kind of placate and stabilize. So if you did ever get into a situation where the rates looked destabilizing, a rate move looked destabilizing, I think that you'll hear the Fed come in and try to sort of stop that. Now, tying that view back into your first question, maybe the answer isn't necessarily the Fed, though, but these large structural positions that are out there. I mean, if you look at some of the big bond funds that have interest rate sensitivity, if you look at maybe some of the central banks overseas that are holding large pools of treasuries, it may not be the tapering that causes this issue, but it might be investors moving away from fixed income generally. I mean, there's some large concentrated pools of assets out there that look vulnerable, and so I think that's something to keep in mind as well.
So why don't we wrap it up, and thank you, Bill. Thank you for your comments and your thoughts today.